Welcome to the Hearsay Culture and Network and another edition of R&D with D&D. I'm Dave Levine, joined by my co-host Denise Howell. Denise, great to see you again.
Hey, Dave. Always so good to see you.
Today, we're very excited to be joined by the author of the book, Screening Big Data, Films That Shape Our Algorithmic Literacy. The author is Gerald Sim. Gerald is a professor of film and media studies and the iSense Ethics and Society Fellow at Florida Atlantic University. He's the author of The Subject of Film and Race, Retheorizing Politics, Ideology, and Cinema, and Postcolonial Hangups in Southeast Asian Cinema, Poetics of Space, Sound, and Stability. Who isn't a fan of films, at least if you're a technologist and into technology, that are about technology? And so when I came across Gerald's book on one of the academic listservs, the Association of Internet Researchers, I pretty much jumped on it. Nothing better with a radio show or podcast than have an excuse to read books that I might read anyway and then talk to those authors. And so Denise and I jumped at the opportunity to chat with Gerald. In this book, Gerald takes a very close and detailed look at not only how technology is portrayed in film, but very interestingly, how filmmakers use technology to share ideas, to create worlds, and ultimately to shape how the public might think about technology itself. And this is a very subtle area because we can think about films that go back right to the beginning. We can think about films like Metropolis from 100 years ago, right? You know, films that began the study of how urban societies might operate in the future world. Of course, most people are still familiar with the 1968 film 2001, where Hal, as Gerald points out, starts realizing that the computer might be killing him. And then more recently, we have films involving, as the subtitle of the book suggests, films that shape our algorithmic literacy, films like Moneyball and Minority Report and others, where we see the impacts of technology operating in time and space. So Gerald, as a film and communication scholar, takes a deep look here, and we're going to dive right in on many of these issues. Gerald is joining us via Zoom, as is Denise. I believe on the other side of the country from where I am on the East Coast, and Gerald is here. We're on the East Coast, I'm sorry, and Denise is on the West Coast. Gerald, thank you for joining us today on R&D with D&D.
Excited to be here, and thrilled to have the chance to talk to your audience.
Absolutely. Let's dive right in. Right, I was really fascinated to read and to frame the book. You dig deep into a lot of philosophical concepts that I've seen come up in books like Shannon Valor's book, Technology and the Virtues, and other books that focus directly on how we should think about AI, but how we should think about technology more broadly. And you point out that algorithms express a Platonic view of technology as operating outside or above the frailties of people. And this seems a particularly important time, we're recording on February 11th, 2025, right, to be assessing how culture receives technological narratives. Why did you choose to take on this book now?
I think it wasn't necessarily a choice per se. I think it just was an organic evolution out of my from my interests. I was originally sort of trained as a traditional film scholar. And sort of historical technological developments overtook me, eventually, so to speak, with the advent of digital cinema. So I was forced, as every one of my peers were, to start thinking about films differently, to think about cinema differently, with, for example, the rise of Netflix or the rise of digital cinematography and such, right? And so the way I went about thinking about it was really from my intellectual sympathies with the Frankfurt School. That was what I wrote my dissertation on. That was what my first book is sort of based on. And so I kind of looked at it in that broad sense, right? Not the media industry, capitalism as a whole. And so, you know, because of that, right, I tended to look at, to appraise these celebratory statements, proclamations about what digital media, digital cinema, would bring and how it would radicalize or transform spectatorship, production. And I always found invariably, right, that it was just overhype, right? And you just shouldn't just never believe that history proceeds in the way and in the with the speed that the hype says it does. And it's still true today. And so for example, one of the first things I wrote about was about Netflix and how, you know, if you believe Reed Hastings, is that it transfers power from producers to spectators, right? That you weren't slave anymore to a traditional broadcast television schedule, that you could watch whatever you want, whenever you wanted, on whatever device you wanted, and that was empowering, that was democratizing, and you know that's a big sort of tagline you hear over and over again, that technology is going to empower the little person, that is going to democratize consumption, and if you think about it just a little bit, you realize that it's never the case. Right, it's always about shoring up power for people who already have political and economic power.
We certainly see a lot of that today. I think it goes to Denise's next question.
Yeah, definitely. I am a huge, huge fan of science fiction in both film and literary form. But I think even for people who aren't, in the past, as Dave said at the top of the show, you could safely say most people would be familiar with, say, 2001: A Space Odyssey, or, say, Terminator. Hugely science fiction oriented productions, but that had this broad, sweeping, cross-cultural reach. And with your point about Netflix, it intrigues me that we're now at this time where you can't really say that with great certainty anymore, that the storytelling aspect and the ability to reach a mass audience with your stories is so fragmented now. And one of the things, using Netflix again as an example from your point, it may not have shifted power, but it certainly shifts what people watch and their ability to select, so that we don't have this universality of consumption anymore. And I'm wondering, in the context of that, especially with regard to sort of dystopian stories like Netflix and Terminator, and since we're talking about Netflix, Dark Mirror, which, I don't know what percentage of a broad audience that has reached, but if you've watched several episodes of Dark Mirror, you might have a whole different take on tech's role in society and whether it's a beneficence thing or not. And it might then shape, future actions, how you vote, how you approach the world. So I'm wondering, I guess my question is two parts. Where do you sort of see the film storytelling component of society right now, given this fragmentation? And where do you see the role of dystopian stories in shaping how people interact with and make decisions about technology?
So the this kind of follows up on my sort of previous response, right? That, you know, Netflix's initial promise, either explicitly or implicitly, was that it could that its deep personalization, right, its ability to send you or curate for you, right, individualized screening lists through its recommendation algorithm, which is powerful in its own right, right? It's considered an industry leader. But the argument was that because of that algorithm, because of deep personalization, it would send you and create for you a niche, right? A cultural niche. And that it would eventually lead to greater forms of specificity, greater forms of uniqueness, and you would be able to express through your choices your own sort of authentic individual preferences. What we found out is that the opposite is true, right? That Netflix is moving towards thoroughly generic, thoroughly bland programming. There are some shows, of course, that go against the grain. So, you know, when it took over, when it found the audience for Black Mirror, and it decided to fund a few extra seasons of it, you know, shows like that, its content, like what it would, the films it funded for, it financed for Scorsese, for example. Those are actually the exceptions, right? Those are the exceptions. What is the typical Netflix product is Extraction, right? That's kind of interesting enough to keep your attention for, like, I don't know, 30 minutes, or, you know, or a show like Queen's Gambit, right? Which is a lot more interesting when you're reading the synopsis than when you're actually watching it. And it follows up on my previous response, because the Frankfurt School would explain this, that, you know, the culture industry, you know, before was able to accommodate, right, critical, mildly radical artifacts of culture. But in the long run, for the most part, it standardizes, right? So it's so Netflix, in a way, so in the same way Netflix is able to bring us Scorsese, or, you know, mildly reflective work like Black Mirror, but that ultimately, right, what it really wants to show us is Extraction. I can't recall your second question. Could you remind me of that?
Sure. So the shows that we're talking about, Black Mirror being a prime example, they tend to be pretty dystopian in flavor. That technology and its more nefarious aspects, such as surveillance and invasion of privacy, are not our friend. And just I guess the role of that sort of fear-driven storyline in how we as citizens make decisions in our lives and decisions about the future of society.
Well, you know, the thing about the book, right, is that I don't talk about all films about AI. I don't talk about all films about big data. And a very sort of conscious decision I made was to not dwell on what you describe, which are the dystopian science fiction films. I think I do devote a chapter to Minority Report, but that's really about it. The thing about the dystopian science fiction films is, number one, I couldn't really think about anything new to say, right? A lot of people have said a lot about these kinds of films, but that very often, too often, they were about artificial general intelligence, which, you know, is problematic to me because it takes attention away, for one, from just regular old machine learning, which is wreaking enough havoc, right, on our world. The thing about dystopian narratives, right, is that, you know, whether it's dystopian or utopian, they both propagate this idea of inevitability, that AGI is coming, it's coming fast, and it might be good, it might be bad, but we can't really stop it. And, you know, that does a lot of cultural, ideological work in my mind.
Yeah, it's fascinating you point that out. A couple of things there, you know, Gerald. I share your concern that, you know, thinking about the edge cases or the worst case scenarios removes our gaze from the day-to-day mundane behaviors that impact people more greatly and which are not being thought through. And it's interesting you point out that that you consciously chose to move aside from the dystopian films because you felt like you couldn't add something to the discussion, which I will say reflects modesty, perhaps, but also reflects the fact that we don't tend to think about the films that inculcate technology in ways other than these very dramatic settings. You describe your view of what's going on as the quote techno media industrial complex with, and perhaps an ironic nod to President Eisenhower in that sense. And I'm interested in how you see that playing a role today. On February 12th, 2025, where we see what's hard not to describe as a budding technological oligarchy that's now surrounding our current president. My question on that front, it boils down to this. In all of that world that we're talking about, technology mediates information and very much is the mediator of information. And of course, that's the debate around misinformation and disinformation, which is not a subject of your book, but is part of the algorithmic world. You use an example of the misunderstanding of silencers in the book with regard to guns, which I think is a very important point that I'd like you to amplify. And my question really is if you could describe that, and then does the misunderstanding of silencers and the function of silencers, right, lie with the entertainment industry, with people like Senator Gillibrand, with the media, with the law, with policymakers, with some or all of the above, or am I missing the mark?
Oh, no, I think, you know, I use the example for a reason, right, but more as an illustration of the power of the movies, right, or of cinema. For those of you who haven't read the book, should I explain?
Yeah, you can describe it. Yes, please. Okay.
So I talk about this, how there was some gun legislation being debated, and Kirsten Gillibrand, at the time, might have been the junior senator from New York, she tweeted that she opposed legalizing suppressors, which are silencers, because if you use silencers, like the law enforcement wouldn't be able to locate, right, where gunshots are coming from, essentially. That, of course, betrays like a complete misunderstanding, a lack of understanding of how guns work and how suppressors work, and that even if you screw on a suppressor, it doesn't create this squishing sound that you hear in the movies, right? So I point out this scene in, I guess to me, like this emblematic scene, which is this one in, I think, John Wick Part 2, where Keanu Reeves and Common are fighting each other or shooting at each other over crowds of people, like in a crowdway subway station, right? And they're all oblivious, right? Because they're both using suppressors, right?
Yeah.
Completely false, right? And it won't really happen, but believable, because what we understand, how we understand suppressors to work, has been constructed, right, by decades of movie sound convention, and so. You know, the way in which cinema, right, or movies and films can sort of inhabit our imagination and just determine how we see the world and how we think about the world very often is so powerful that it overrides our, I guess, literal understanding to the contrary, right? That, you know, you can, for example, educate someone, right, by putting out, I don't know, a book or an article, or tell someone directly, this is not how something works. But because, right, they've watched, they've consumed media for like decades, it is so embedded that it really overdetermines, right, overrides their cognition, essentially, right, their logic. And so, when there are these documentaries I write about where, they are ostensibly trying to educate its audience, its PBS audience, for example, of about data and AI. But the sequence and the barrage of images, right, coming at them, really trigger, right, so much more that, what they might necessarily be learning from interviews and talking heads might actually be, again, sort of overridden, right, by the media, visual and, I mean, oral vocabulary, right, that is also being mobilized in the process.
So if I understand your response correctly, then it would seem like the answer to my question is that we need to put heavy responsibility on issues involving misinformation and disinformation on the medium themselves, right? In other words, the platforms that are putting that out there as a means of sharing information, and perhaps by not tailoring it or altering it in a different way. Or is that not the full story when it comes to mis and disinformation?
Yeah, I think that's the purpose of the book,
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
That it's an argument for cultural literacy, media literacy, in addition to, I guess, what is very needed, algorithmic or technological literacy, and the move to exclude dystopian films with sentient robots, right? Like Ex Machina or 2001 was part of that, right? Just to get people to think about why the book isn't about those films. As lawyers, you might be interested in this, right? That this emphasis, this constant emphasis on AGI and sentient robots, nurtures this understanding that artificial intelligence is, no, that algorithms and AI systems are sentient, right?
Right, right.
They have agency,
Yeah.
right? Agentic AI is a thing,
Yeah.
right? If you read enough tech, and the thing about that is that it, there's this philosophical concept called the technological responsibility gap, and it's this idea that we have this technology that is autonomous or independent in some way, that it does things that whoever makes the technology or constructs it cannot predict, right? And because we cannot predict the effect or the actions of the technology, we cannot hold anybody accountable, right? So there's this responsibility gap, and so every time we watch a film where AI, whatever that means, right? Because it means several things. Every time we associate that with an agent, every time we associate that with a human, right? Every time we associate that with something or someone that makes autonomous decisions, it maintains and even expands that techno responsibility gap, right? Which is important, right? Because if we know anything about how Silicon Valley acts, is that they're not really about accountability, right? They're not really about responsibility. So
Move
that's
that
the kind
fast
of,
and break things, baby.
yeah, exactly.
for sure. For sure.
I get your point, and I agree that there should be more responsibility in the on the production side of things that are going to be mass consumed. But I also think it's hard to expect that. Going back to the example with silencers. There's such an established trope about this now. It's not just the John Wick film. It's every film and television show where someone is shooting with a silencer. Those Foley artists have that down, and they know what they think or what movies think that sounds like, but it's not apparently what that actually sounds like. And not having any particular personal experience with silencers, I didn't know that till I read your book. And I think I'm not alone. And so if a film decided I'm going to have, and let's go with a fictional film, because I would say that documentarians have a higher degree of responsibility in that regard. But let's go with a fictional film, and the director decides, you know what, we're going to make that sound like what a silencer actually sound like. So it's going to make a real noise, and people aren't going to be able to ignore it. Probably, you know, they're going to get pushback from the audience that says, hey, that gun had a silencer on it. You know, why did it sound that way? It would be a huge learning curve to get people over that. But I kind of digress. My question against that context is, knowing that there is this sort of disconnect between what storytelling can or will attempt to accomplish and reality, do you have any best practices that, you know, with your deep knowledge and understanding of how all this is functioning, do you approach social media or search or email or messaging or credit cards or any of these other ubiquitous data collection front ends that infuse our lives? And of course, the entertainment itself and news itself. Do you have any tips or techniques that you use so that you know that you're getting a legitimate depiction?
I guess the one tip, right, is don't believe Silicon Valley. The second thing I would say, right, is that the book actually assiduously avoids coming up with solutions. There is no proper way, I'm to make a film, and I didn't want. I don't think I can even, right, come up with a way to properly make a film. The book is fundamentally about techno politics and the politics around our technology and the political economy of our technology. And that, that these films express and carry water for sometimes, right? Certain types of techno political. Affinities, and that awareness should inform ultimately what we do, and what we do, most importantly, I think most consequentially, is political. The point I try to make about the silencer example, is that it kind of shut down debate, because Senator Gillibrand tweeted that, right? And for anybody who is into gun culture, sort of immediately looks at that and says, "You don't understand guns. You therefore won't understand me." So that just undermines, right? That short circuits any kind of political action, and it is political action that ultimately I do say in the book, right? That political action is necessary. That individual. Actions, individual decision making around what you watch, for example, or just a th thoroughly unimportant. It's kind of like recycling, right? Your individual decision to recycle might make you feel good, right? But ultimately, what's really going to make a real difference is at the level of policy, right? It's at the level of government. I wonder if I really, sort of addressed your question there.
No, you did. I do think that, you know, these misconceptions that we get from things like film and media in general, do ultimately have political impact because, you know, even in your example, Kristen Gillibrand is not just some average citizen; she's an actual policymaker, and so her policy is being shaped by a misconception that could have been readily dispelled. And you know, I think back to my own experience with guns. I probably have more than a lot of people I know because I have friends who are pretty steeped in gun culture and have exposed me to it. But I've never, there was no reason to ever put a silencer on anything. So
Right.
there, I have no personal experience with that. And I think that would be, a lot of people who wanted to be, more conversant with how things actually work and what their broader ramifications might be. And then, it's those personal conceptions that shape how we vote and how we, if you're a lawmaker, how you're going to propose legislation and draft it. So yeah, it's a thorny issue that,
Yeah, and the point I also wanted to make about, with the gun example, right, is that it sort of brings the debate into culture, especially with guns, right? Where it's really not about in a lot of important ways. The gun debate is not really about public safety. That the state of the gun debate is what it is because it's a debate about culture, right? It's a fight over culture and not about public safety. And so culture is important, right? And what contributes to that culture is important. And on that, right, I would kind of rephrase how we talk about these films and what's responsible for these films and how they represent our reality, in that a lot of the norms, what determines that? What determines how our reality is represented is very often just norms and not individual decisions. If you're, as maybe Dave mentioned, if you're a Foley artist, right, and or you're a filmmaker working with a Foley artist, and you decide, hey, we're going to use silencers, and they're going to sound like, what suppressors sound like. It's not going to make sense, right? Number one, to your audience, and secondly, silencers usually have a narrative purpose, right? Our action heroes use silencers because they want to go undetected, right? So that whole scene itself, right, the whole setup of that scene itself doesn't really make any sense at all, and so it goes beyond what the point I'm trying to make is it very often goes beyond, right, the decision of any one individual, and that very often it's the culture that makes a decision. It's an institution that pre-decides, right, such these creative moves.
Well, and of course, on that point, Gerald, I mean, it comes back to, and we'll get to it, kind of the oligarchic world that we operate. Let's not forget that for the most, every film and every show that we talked about here is being created by a for-profit entity that needs eyeballs, right? And so the, that sound of the silencer being dramatic, sells the film in a way that maybe authenticity lacks. And that kind of gets me to another film that you spend time with in the book, that the film Moneyball, which is about 20 years old, starring Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill, based upon the true story of Billy Beane.
Good God, has it been 20?
It has been. It's crazy. Yeah, it's been that long. And Brad Pitt doesn't look like he's aged one bit, but of course that's because he's Brad Pitt. So he looks about the same, but it has been that long. Moneyball, for those aren't familiar, is a film about Billy Beane, who was for a time the general manager of the Oakland A's, and who brought statistics, more or less, and elevated statistics and statistical modeling around choosing baseball teams and choosing baseball players. I think it's the, at least personally, I think it's the greatest film to elevate tech decision making over the human being that I've seen. I mean, putting aside the dystopian films, which have a different tenor to them. And I want to share a scene with you and get your reaction to it. I'm going to show it in two parts, but for viewers, it's a scene where Billy sits down with his team of scouts, along with and who's played by Brad Pitt, along with Jonah Hill, who plays his assistant, who's the techie, nerdy, guy who is going to come up with a whole new way of deciding how the Oakland A's should win baseball games. So I'm going to show this clip, and Gerald, I want to get your reaction to it in terms of what it's portraying about technology and what we should take from this scene.
Billy, we got 38 home runs and 120 RBIs.
Guys, we're still trying to replace Giambi. I told you we can't do it. We can't do it. Now, what we might be able to do is recreate him. Recreate him in the aggregate.
The what?
Giambi's on-base percentage was .477. Damon's on-base, .324. And Almeida's was .291. Add that up and you get...
You want me to speak?
What not point of you yet?
.1092.
Divided by three.
.364.
That's what we're looking for. Three ball players whose average OBP is...
.364.
That doesn't look...
All right. So we're going to stop there. Gerald, what's your reaction to this? I mean, I think it's a great scene because, you know, it demonstrates this stark clash between, you know, the human decision-making model and the view of the all of the intangibles, as some of the characters there talk about later on, right? And the elevation of technology and statistics and going back to the original theme, this Platonic notion of using statistics and numbers as a way to solve for human frailties and human errors. What's your reaction to that?
What I say in the book, right, is that Moneyball is a forceful case. It makes a forceful case on behalf of machine learning, right, and analytics. And it does so by, you know, placing us in identification with Brad Pitt against some really old, right, particularly old, crotchety, ornery Hollywood character actors with whom you would not want to, right? They're especially wrinkly, right? They're made up to be especially wrinkly. And so you don't want to be them, right? You want to be like Brad Pitt, because you don't necessarily want to be like Jonah Hill either, not in the way that he's, you know, that character is portrayed.
Right.
And one of the, you know, politically interesting things about the film is that we're actually distanced from Jonah Hill's character, right? This is Jonah Hill in his, you know, one of his more physically unappealing phases, right? And that's important, right? Because he's this nerd character. He's this asocial, antisocial character who is separate from the world, right? Like, Brad has to snap his fingers, point to him, and he still doesn't, you know that he can enter the world. Yeah, right. And so the parallel there is with the real world and this ephemeral, ethereal realm of Platonic knowledge. Right. And what I say about, you know, the nerd character, right, has particular sort of relevance today. Right. Because the Peter Brand, Jonah Hill's character in Moneyball, he's just a standard sort of nerd, right? But nerd personas and nerd culture is also tied up with neurodiversity, and it places us in a very specific relationship with people we associate with that with those characteristics. Right. So the thing about nerds, right, is that a lot of them, and this is neither, you know, this is not bad, right? But they believe, right? There are studies that have shown that they believe that because they're objective, right? Because they think logically, because their minds are given to thinking rationally, that they're just incapable of being subjective. They're incapable of bias.
Yeah. Right.
So that's how they act, right? So that's how they act. And that's why it's difficult, for example, to just say, talk to engineers about the possibility, right? The remote, you know, they can't, won't even entertain the notion, right, that their technology is socially inflected, right? It's culturally inflected or ideologically inflected, is has values within them, right? And, you know, the political, you know, the other sort of political angle to this, right, is the connection to neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. The point I make in the book is that even though Peter Brand's character is not portrayed as being neurodiverse, that when it circulates in culture, it is, right? And that very often, because we're encouraged, and the film does this, the film encourages us to let Peter Brand be weird as he is weird, right? That it's a good thing that he's weird. It's a good thing that he's not social, because that's the source of his power. That's the source of his insight. And we should just let him be, right? We should not expect him to act in the interests of society, right? Because he can't be expected to think that way. And how does this appear, or in real life? Well, we just saw that, right? With the Nazi salute. I don't like. This is an instance where I didn't really like being correct here, right? Because what happens is that with the Nazi salute, with the Google memo,
And just
and
to
the
be
person who
clear,
wrote the Google memo with.
you're talking about Musk's use of that gesture, correct? Or are you talking about it in a
Of
different
the salute,
context?
yeah.
Yeah, okay, just want to make sure we're clear.
Yeah. And a couple of years ago, with the problematic Google memo that got one of his developers fired, right? Or with any number of public controversies involving Mark Zuckerberg, is that.
And that memo is the one where the engineer was positing that perhaps their AI was starting to become sentient.
Oh, no, I'm
No,
sorry.
not
So
that
there's this internal Google memo that one of his engineers had circulated on, I guess, the internal Slack or something, talking about Google's at the time they didn't use DEI, but their culture of diversity, right? The priority that they placed on encouraging diversity. And he just kind of postulated, right, that maybe there are fundamental genetic differences between men and women, right? And and it was problematic, right? Like it's not easy to see why it's problematic. I assigned that memo to my students, and almost all of them just immediately said, this doesn't make any sense, right? It pretends to be objective and scientific, but it's actually not at all, right? It's written by somebody who only took engineering classes, right? Which is, again, not his fault, because that's how engineering curricula are structured. But with that engineer, with Mark Zuckerberg, and with Musk recently, right? Just for three examples, they do something that's, let's say, unacceptable, right? And part of the move, right, part of the PR move, for example, for them to avoid accountability, is to just float it out there, right? That they're on the spectrum, right? That they can't be expected to be re socially responsible, or to other people, right? To other human beings, right? Because they're on the spectrum. And so, it's
Well, and
not.
I would go even further than that and say there's almost an assumption in society that if you've risen to that level of prowess in that field, that you probably are.
Right.
And the irony, of course, right, in the context of what's happening today, right, that the argument that they should not be held accountable, right, the argument that we should think about them just a little differently. I mean, that's kind of DEI, isn't it?
That's an excellent point.
That is a good point. And of course, it does turn on its head. To your last point, right? The premises associated with why we want diverse culture, and of course, the kind of society that ultimately you are certainly in, and we certainly would like to see of inclusivity, and in many instances, we see a perversion of those values for different goals. In the interest of time, Gerald, I want to very quickly show this last clip before we go to our rapid fire questions, just to kind of close the ring. And I think it's an appropriate way to close the discussion before we do the rapid fire. This is the scene now fast forwarding, where Brad Pitt has a one-on-one conversation with his head scout based upon this meeting that basically, as we pointed out, has Brad pushing statistics over the other values and intuitions of his professional scouts.
You're unhappy, Grady. Why? Wow. May I speak candidly?
Sure, go ahead.
Major League Baseball and its fans, they're going to be more than happy to throw you and Google Boy under the bus if you keep doing what you're doing here. You don't put a team together with a computer, Billy.
No?
No. Baseball isn't just numbers. It's not science. If it was, then anybody could do what we're doing, but they can't because they don't know what we know. They don't have our experience, and they don't have our intuition.
Okay.
Billy, you got a kid in there that's got a degree in economics from Yale. You got a scout here with 29 years of baseball experience. You're listening to the wrong one. Now, there are intangibles that only baseball people understand. You're discounting what scouts have done for 150 years, even yourself.
Adapt or die.
Which, of course, adapt or die is very, very much the attitude that we see today in terms of, as you pointed out earlier, the inevitability of technological outcomes and the unwillingness, really, in a lot of ways, to have deviation from it. Gerald, any quick responses to that clip before we hit you with some rapid fire questions as we close our discussion?
Sure. I mean, a few things, right? And which is that, I guess, first and foremost, is that that particular scene can be read more than one way, mm-hmm. right? That this film makes an argument on behalf of analytics is my position. And because of that, we're on the side of Brad Pitt, right? Against that old scout with his antiquated methods. But very often, in real life, right? The real life manager, right, who's trying to impose quote unquote AI on how we do work, right, is really the bad guy, mm-hmm. right? He adapt or die, right. For them, right, is we don't really care like how, you know, what you do, right? We don't really care. You might not have asked for this technology, but you should use it.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, one of the things that valuable parts of using the Frankfurt School is that we have this understanding of culture as very often saying contradictory things, and it can say right contradictory things as a way to kind of embed itself in our sort of imagination. Just as a sort of brief plug to a recent piece I wrote for the journal Flow, and to bring it back full circle to Netflix. Netflix has, you know, somewhere on its website, right, is this blog entry about how its engineers wrote this, came up with this system, built this system to help film editors assemble graphic matches, mm-hmm. right? Or match cuts. And just to keep a long story short, right? If you understand anything about match cuts and how they're made and their purpose, the actual model has nothing to do, right? Does not understand what an editor works. So they built this system, right, for editors. They say it's for editors, and I do not doubt that somewhere in their stable, they're pushing this system on some poor editor somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's nothing they ever asked for. It's probably going to compromise what they do, but they're going to do it nonetheless.
Well, and I'll tell exactly, Jared. And I'll tell you, I mean, as before Denise starts us off with our rapid fire questions, I mean, this resonates very closely with me, because to make a long story short, my father was in book publishing, and was in his, I grew up around printing presses and glue and paper and ink and brass plates that stamped, words. And it was when the newer technologies appeared, 25 years ago, my father's skills were rendered obsolete, and he was not able to more or less, you know, continue in that profession because as Brad Pitt says at the end there, adapt or die. On that somewhat rough note, Denise, why don't we turn to our rapid fire questions before we close today?
Yeah. Just to reflect on what we're talking about here, though, that scene 20 years on could not more beautifully capture the conflict we see today between folks who want to value and preserve the human aspect of analysis and contribution to the work world and what AI can accomplish. So it's pretty prescient right there. Yeah. All right. So against the backdrop of everything we've been discussing today and your book, Gerald, what's one movie about technology or with technological themes that you think everyone should see?
Let me rephrase that.
All right. I don't know. Is that Denise? Is that allowed? I don't know.
I'll allow it.
All right. Okay.
I think that a film about technology that everybody has seen is Minority Report, right? Which we didn't get to today, right? But everybody talks about it and thinks about it as if they've seen the whole thing really carefully, and you know, it doesn't really say what people thinks it says, right? Minority Report is a sort of a darling of Wired, for example. And every couple of years, you know, there's a Wired article talking about Minority Report and how it's great and exactly why it's great. And its politics are actually very different than the way in which it is usually thought of. And so I would say Minority Report, even if you've seen it, I would watch it again, maybe after reading the book. But, you know, and I recommend it just because, you know, people always, even people who haven't seen it, talk about it like they have.
Right.
You've probably seen clips of it.
Yeah. And there are only two clips that they're talking about. Right. Mm-hmm. The one with the holographic ads when he's walking to the train station, and the scene early on where he's in front of the interface, right? Yes. Manipulating this precursor to the iPad. And, you know, they seem like technologically sort of prescient scenes that say something about, I guess, Spielberg's genius. Right. But it's important, I think, to kind of resist the narrative from Wired here.
I think it's
fascinating that film, the core technology or the core, you know, predictive algorithm of that film is biologically based. It's the three humans. That was an interesting choice.
Yeah. What about the most overrated? Your turn, Dave. Yeah, thank you, Denise. What about the most overrated tech film?
Terminator.
Yep.
Just because, again, like, you know, people, the phrase "that scene from Minority Report" just rolls off people's tongue,
right?
Right. Skynet, right, is this thing that people refer to just unthinkingly, and it's a distraction, right? Terminator more than other films. Is a thorough distraction from what is happening today. It's a work of such discouragement for what we can do today to change what is before us.
All right, we have four rapid fire.
Along these same lines, best tech TV show or series?
This might be a weird choice, but I will make the case nonetheless. Fringe.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
What about your favorite app?
Let me make a case for Blue Sky.
Yep.
I think we're all converts.
Yeah, we're pretty active there.
Yeah. So generative AI is increasingly part of the educational experience, whether educators want it to be or not. What do you think about people who learn to write using generative AI?
Oh, wow. Well, I would tell them that you have not learned how to write.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing, I mean, I encountered this a lot, right? Where, because I do what I do, tech folks trying to push AI onto education. And one of the recent ones was, I forget what the system actually did or what they said it could do, but the pitch was that it would enable us, it would free us from the work of writing lectures or writing assignments, so that we could do the real teaching, right? Of, I think, classroom interaction is what they meant. And that has absolutely no understanding of what teaching is, right? Of that teaching, so much of teaching goes is devoted to, writing those assignments, right? I mean, they just don't understand it. They don't value it, which is not to sort of de-emphasize the importance of classroom pedagogy, right? But it's just about the glibness and the reductiveness of that statement, right? But right after that, they'll say adapt or die, and it's not really adapt or die. It's really adapt or we're probably going to kill you.
Well, that yeah, and so maybe that's a scary way to get to our last question. So, therefore, what is the best city for the tech inclined, for the nerds? Where do you recommend they live? If you have to pick one, Gerald.
Now, when you say tech inclined, what do you mean?
I mean people who like technology, who are nerds, and who want to bask the way that the brand character in Moneyball might.
Well, if I can again
All right,
rephrase
I guess Denise set the precedent. We're going to have to talk about we'll have to talk about this precedent separately and see if this is how we want to do things. But yes, okay, I'll allow that as well.
I would say I would pick a city that allows you to be the biggest Luddite,
Okay.
and Luddism as it is currently being sort of reinvigorated and brought back into the fold by writers like Brian Merchant. And that Luddism is not about opposition to technology, it's about opposition to exploitation, right? So any city, did you say, right,
Yes.
that is friendly to organizing, any city that is friendly to activism and protest.
Gerald
And I,
Sim,
I,
yeah.
I should, if I can say one more thing,
Yeah.
right? And I recently, because this just came up in class the other day, one of the things I ask students about, just to get to know them, is I ask them, if you weren't here today, right, in this class, what would you rather be doing? And I say, most of you would probably say sleeping, as I would. But if that's the case, go to the second one, right?
Yeah.
And almost all of them, listed an activity that was essentially unplugging. Right? They talked about being in places and doing things where they did not need to be plugged in, and so that says something about us that perhaps we should acknowledge a little more.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Gerald Sim, author of the book Screening Big Data, Films That Shape Our Algorithmic Literacy, recently published by Routledge. Thank you so much for joining us, Denise and I, on R&D with D&D on the Hearsay Culture Network. And we look forward to chatting with you and staying in touch going forward.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Gerald. Take care.